Thanks for listening to the Best of Herd Podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 12 to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. Find your local station for the Herd at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching Herd.
This is the Best of the Herd with Colin Cowherd on Fox Sports Radio.
Ah, here we go on a Tuesday live in Los Angeles. This is The Herd. Wherever you may be and however you may be listening, we're on iHeartRadio, Fox Sports Radio, and FS1. John Lynch, the San Francisco 49ers general manager, who many believe had the best weekend of everybody, will be joining us at the top of next hour. Joy Taylor is joining me on a Tuesday. Still talking some Last Dance and the NFL draft today. Joy, how are you?
I'm good. We got a little preview on Instagram of bartender Colin.
Yeah, last night. You know, Instagram, I'm starting to, you know, when you have all this spare time at home, you have things to do at home. So I told my social guys, I'm going to do some Instagramming at home. That's the new me. I'll do some Instagram. I got all this time. You're home at 12. My wife joked yesterday. She's like, you're already home? I'm like, there's nobody on the road. It takes me 15 minutes to get home now. So we start with this. Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys, is talking about this weekend's draft. And Jerry says, it's the best draft class since 2005. He goes, oh, we have Marion Barber. We stole him. And DeMarcus Ware. We stole him. They got so many good players back in 2005. That's interesting. What Jerry doesn't mention is that the reason the 2005 draft class looks really good is because the following year, 2006, Tony Romo started playing quarterback, and they made the playoffs immediately. DeMarcus Ware is irrelevant if you're 5-11 or 6-10. Nobody cared about Calais Campbell until the Jags had a really good season. Otherwise, he's just disappearing in Florida. Now, teams bidding on him. Yeah, the reason Marion Barber looks like a steal in 2005, because in 2006, Tony Romo starts and gets you to the playoffs, and people actually see him. This league's all about quarterback and coach. That's it. If Mike McCarthy and Dak work, then this will look like a great draft. C.D. Lamb, 800 yards, couple of touchdowns. Man, it's really... If Dak and Mike McCarthy don't work, and they haven't had OTAs, and that we may have no preseason... It doesn't matter. I mean, let's ask yourself right now. Do you think it's a coincidence that the teams favored to win the Super Bowl? Go look at Fox Bet or Vegas. Are all the teams that have really good head coaching quarterback combinations? There's really no exception. In my opinion, here are 1 through 10 the best quarterback and coaching combinations. Mahomes and Andy Reid, Ebby number 1, Russell Wilson, Pete Carroll's 2, for one more year, Breeze and Sean Payton, Carson Wentz and Doug Peterson, Lamar Jackson and John Harbaugh, Tom Brady and Bruce Arians, number 7, Garoppolo and Kyle Shanahan, number 8, Goff and McVay, number 9, Big Ben and Tomlin, though Tomlin can drive me crazy, and number 10, Aaron Rodgers and Matt LaFleur. And by 10, we're guessing on Matt LaFleur. We don't know if he's a good coach. Tennessee's offense got better when he left. Their offense popped this year when Matt LaFleur left. And Green Bay, Aaron Rodgers' numbers went down when he arrived. They didn't get better. Is Dak and McCarthy better than Mike Zimmer and Kirk Cousins? No, I'd put them 11. Is it better than Deshaun Watson and Bill O'Brien? Well, Dak ain't Deshaun. I'd put them at 12. What about Gruden and Carr, Frank Reich, Phillip Rivers? I mean, so the bottom line on all this stuff and all this drafting stuff, it's kind of nonsense. Who's your coach? Who's your quarterback? You could make so many mistakes in this league. You can have so many injuries like Philadelphia. The fact Philadelphia made the playoffs is all about Carson Wentz and Doug Peterson. I mean, where was New England good last year offensively? Receiver? Running back? Tight end? O-line? It was the first time their O-line struggled. They had the coach and the quarterback. That's why at the end of the year, pretty interesting team, getting to the playoffs. So when I look at, wow, our 2005 draft in Dallas was great. No, Tony Romo starts the next year, makes the playoffs, and elevates all those players around him. That's the difference. That's the difference. You can give the quarterback more credit like they do in Kansas City, or you can give the coach more credit like they're doing now with the Niners But they both have to be B-plus to A, or you're not getting to conference championships. Let's shift to this. The Packers were apparently, according to Ian Rappaport, determined to trade up for Jordan Love. They were, quote, adamant about getting him. They arranged multiple deals to trade up, including one deal in which the Packers would have moved up to number 27 in a trade with Seattle. No other team was this interested in Jordan Love. Now, I'm not going to criticize the Packers if they fell in love with Jordan Love, like Andy Reid fell in love with Patrick Mahomes. I'm not going to criticize them for that. When Kansas City said, Brett Veach, the GM, fell in love with Mahomes, and they were right. So I'm not going to bang on the Packers if they really believe Jordan Love. And if you look at Jordan Love, he's big, he's strong, he's mobile, huge arm, huge sophomore year. Hey, let me ask you this. In 2 years, if Jordan Love is a really nice quarterback, are we any of us shocked? None of us are shocked. Some GMs maybe, but none of us would be. 6'4", 225, mobile, big arm, great sophomore year. None of us would be shocked after what we saw with Josh Allen. But what's remarkable with Green Bay, and this is where I'd push back on the Packers, they're not very good at evaluating their team. Green Bay was 13-3 last year. They were a 9-7 team. There's never been a 13-3 team in league history that was outgained. They were outgained. That's almost impossible to be 13-3 and outgained. Both Vegas and Fox Bet has the Packers pulling back 4 wins this year. They have them at a 9-win team. And before you push back, Green Bay, remember when Chicago a couple years ago, Joy, went 12-4 with Trubisky and Vegas went, no. That is not what you are. You're an 8-win team, a 9-win team. What was Chicago this past year? So Green Bay was the luckiest 13-win team in the league. Let's look at the lucky breaks. Oh, they faced Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. Oh, wait, Mahomes didn't play. So they got to face the Chiefs without Patrick Mahomes. They went 2-0 against Detroit and never led in either game. 2 walk-off field goals. They faced a third-place schedule where they got the NFC East with 2 of the worst teams in the league, the Giants and Washington. And then when they did face Seattle in the playoffs, in one of the strangest cluster injuries ever, Seattle in a 2-week period lost all their running backs, and it was mostly a power running team. In fact, Green Bay only beat last year. Think about this. One playoff team all year that had a starting quarterback. They beat Minnesota and Kirk Cousins. That's it. That's the only team they beat. I think they beat him twice. That's it. Well, they beat Kansas City. Mahomes didn't play. So Green Bay won 13. Vegas and Fox Bet has them at 9. They also have Buffalo at 9. You think Buffalo's a Super Bowl team? So my takeaway in Green Bay is I'm not going to bang on you if you believe Jordan Love is 85% Mahomes. 85% Patrick Mahomes is a Pro Bowler. If I'm not going to bang on you, if your personal evaluators see that, but it does strike me that you were behind at half to the Niners in 2 games, 50-0. In fact, one of the games against the San Francisco 49ers, you came off a bye with the brilliant Matt LaFleur and Hall of Famer Aaron Rodgers, and you couldn't score a point. Off a bye. So they're not evaluating their franchise very well. 6 NFC teams have a higher over and under than the Packers. That's what bothers me. It's not that you love Jordan Love. It's that you really think this is the time and the place. Currently, as Aaron Rodgers ages with some collarbone surgeries and injuries, this is the time and the place. Because I don't know what your evaluations are of people. Kansas City moved up on Mahomes because they wanted to play him really quickly. I get Love and Jordan Love, but you're not going to play him for multiple years. But if you're really honest in Wisconsin, if you're truly honest, this was a 9-win team last year that lucked into a 13-3 record. Seattle cluster injuries, Detroit 2-0 never led, faced Kansas City without Patrick Mahomes, a much easier schedule. That schedule this year, look it up. It's on Google, Packers schedule. We don't know when they play teams, but we know who they play, and we know where they play, and it's a much tougher schedule. And we still really don't know, let's be honest. I don't know if Matt LaFleur can coach. I don't know. Tennessee's offense got better. Rodgers' numbers declined. I don't know if he's a great coach. At New Orleans, at San Francisco, I'm just at Tampa with Tom Brady. That's their schedule this year. A little tougher. Eagles come to town. Good luck on that. And they won't be as injury-riddled.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific.
Pistons were finally vanquished by the Chicago Bulls, but the Detroit and the tackling and the physical style of play beat Jordan time and time again. Jordan was always classy with it. You know, after he'd lose, shake their hands, as the video proved. But the Pistons, when they were eventually beaten, walked off the court, would not shake hands with Jordan, and they have been pummeled by fans for years, and this is bringing back all the reality of it. Now, Isaiah Thomas got caught in a big lie, of course, on The Last Dance, and here it is.
We were coming down, Michael Jordan was coming up, and in coming up, you have certain emotions, and in coming down as champions, you have certain emotions. And I've said this many a times, looking back over the years, had we had the opportunity to do it all over again, I think all of us would make a different decision.
He also went on to say, but back then, people just didn't do that. No, he said that. We have that bite, too. People just didn't do it back then. You know, shake hands and stuff. The problem, of course, is everybody did it back then. Yeah, everybody back then actually, you know, shook hands. High school, college, AAU, NBA, NFL, Stanley Cup playoffs, Major League Baseball. Everybody shook hands. And he goes on to say, you know, you look back on it. Yeah, I look back on it, and we actually had tape of it, of Michael Jordan congratulating the Pistons three times and the Pistons not congratulating Michael Jordan. But I think it's actually fitting how we remember the Pistons. Not all Super Bowl teams are the same. Some have style and grace and class. I mean, the Ravens and Trent Dilfer won. They didn't have a lot of style. You know, there wasn't a lot of grace. I mean, the Brad Johnson and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers won a championship. There wasn't a lot of style or a lot of glamour. It's the same in boxing. Muhammad Ali was great, smart, glamorous, and had style. And that's how he's viewed. And then there's Larry Holmes, who had none of that except he held the belt for a long time. That's how they're viewed. Listen, the Pistons never had a lot of class. They never had a lot of grace. They didn't have a lot of style. They tackled people. They had a great coach and one great player, Isaiah Thomas. And that's how we remember them. We remember the Showtime Lakers being great and having style. Those Magic teams had class, style, grace. And when they lost to Michael Jordan, that's how they acted. Magic Johnson met MJ in the hallway, and he had style and class and grace, and that's how they should be remembered. The Pistons are remembered exactly the way a basketball team should be remembered, who played ugly basketball, inartistic basketball, didn't have a lot of grace, really didn't have an offensive style, and, you know, it wasn't the classiest operation. They had a great coach and one great player. That's how we should remember them. That's what they were. Wouldn't it be weird if years later there was this mythology? They were so graceful and you know, tactful. They had such glamour and style. They didn't have any of it. They just tackled people. That's what they did. And the NBA at the time allowed it. It was like, all right, just like the Baltimore Ravens. That wasn't a lot of style. The NFL allowed basic tackling wide receivers. And so at the time, they had great corners and a great pass rush, and they tackled wide receivers, and nobody could move the ball. They would not win today. That Ravens team would struggle in today's NFL. Not athletic enough at quarterback, not dynamic enough offensively, and you can't grab and clutch people. So I think the way we look back at the Pistons is perfect. That's what they were, and now we're catching them again with their disingenuous sort of nonsense. Doesn't bother me at all. Larry Holmes and Muhammad Ali were both champions, two different worldviews on what they were. I don't want to hear mythology that Larry was the classy one. Larry had style. Larry had grace. No, Larry was a heavyweight champ. All he had, style, grace. All he had, and that's what the story should be. This documentary is accurately portraying the Pistons as they are. That's why it's a good documentary. They're not making stuff up. Remember they had that documentary, Making a Murderer? Remember that really popular documentary a few years ago? And my wife just went crazy on it. She's more of an artist. She got really emotional. This is all right. And I said, they're documentarians. They're fudging all the arguments to make it look like that kid's the victim. He killed animals. He stalked women. He was a bad guy. He's just a creepy guy. And my wife's like, and I'm like, these are not reporters. They're documentarians. They have an angle on this that the bad guy is the victim, and that's what they're portraying. In the end, not a real good guy. You start torturing cats and you stalk women. I'm going to go. I can make an easy step to, you may have killed somebody. The reality is, when I look at the Pistons, this documentary is honest. It's honestly portraying what the Pistons were and how they should be viewed. Here's the original Isaiah cut where he got caught lying.
Knowing what we know now, in the aftermath of what took place, I think all of us would have stopped and said, hey, congratulate, like they do now. Hey, congratulate, love you, man, love you. Hey, congratulate you. I mean, we would have did it. Of course we would have done it. But during that period of time, that's just not how it was passed. When you lost, you left the floor. How's it?
That's not true. So again, 20 years later, they're disingenuous. 20 years later, they can't lose with glass. They were. Don't get me wrong. They had a great coach and a great player, and it all kind of worked. But even 20 years later, the Pistons talk, and you're like, Lambert's like, I don't care. Isaiah's making stuff up. It's like, this is exactly how it should be.
Want more Herd? The Herd streams 24 hours a day, 7 days a week within the iHeartRadio app. Search Herd to listen live or on demand whenever you'd like.
John Lynch, I covered him in Tampa. I work with him at Fox. And now he's a 49ers GM who's already got one Super Bowl trip on his resume. So let's start with this. So we went into a virtual draft, and everybody was kind of freaking out, John, about technology and how is it going to work. And then you tied for the most draft day trades. So take me through maybe one of them. Was it frenetic? Was it, did you have it planned? I mean, you were doing all these trades. That goes kind of counterintuitive, John, to what people thought would happen in the draft. So give me one, how you pulled it off.
Well, I would say, first off, I wasn't too prophetic, because I think right before I was asked, and I said, what do you anticipate in this virtual draft? And I said, I think there'll be less trades, because some of the obvious ones up front, you can do a lot of legwork. But then as I always use what I learned at Fox, John Madden used to say, what happens when a game breaks out? You can do all the pre-planning you want.
Right.
But then once you get into the draft, you got to be able to adapt. But the one thing I think where I feel really good about where we're at as an organization is we entrust a lot of people to do their job. And so what you had to do is, we had basically split the league. Adam Peters had eight teams. Mark Mayhew had eight teams. Parag Marate had eight, and I had eight. We split it and such that, trying to anticipate, okay, if we do get to a point, we all can't be on the phone at one time, at one time, on a Zoom at one time, so we have to be able to trust people. And in a couple of those instances, I think the Ayuk trade, I was dealing with Spielman, but the Tampa trade, I think Adam Peters was dealing with his counterpart, John Spytek. And then they just kind of, hey, do you want to go with it? Here's the trade. And bam, we pulled the trigger. And so I give all the IT guys, the video guys, I know within our organization, they were the MVPs of this whole thing. And then at the league, I think they did a tremendous job. It really felt like it went off without a hitch.
Yeah.
In terms of any technological hiccups or anything like that. It was pretty smooth.
One of the positions that you have done a really good job in your staff is skill positions. And we've said before, it's a position that has sometimes flummoxed even Bill Belichick and Pete Carroll. You have nailed your tight end picks, your wide receiver picks, and it's not an easy position. If you go back five drafts, John, there are, I think it was like 20 wide receivers taken in the first round. I could argue 12 to 15 have whiffed. Yours have not. So you go up and you trade up six spots to get Arizona State's Brandon Ayuk. I watched him. I'm a Pac-12 guy. What did you see in Kyle C that attracted you to move up in a wide receiver heavy draft? This kid, what turned you on here? What'd you see?
Well, Brandon was a kid that, really I started seeing, and we started seeing, our scouts were on it long before, but a JC transfer. But we started noticing him when we were studying in Keel Harry. And Keel's a player that we had great interest in last year. He's now with the Patriots.
Yeah.
And as we were studying him, we kept saying, who's this dude? This guy's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, he kept showing up in spurts. And, Herm Edwards is the godfather to my daughter. I'm the godfather to his son. He's one of my closest friends in the world. And as this process started and this year started transpiring, you know, started asking questions about him, our scouts continued to say, this kid, you know, don't let the production or lack thereof. He's a JC kid. They had in Keel last year. Don't let that fool you. Let's keep on being on this guy. And so we watched him throughout the year, and he's a guy that just the more you watch, the more you like. I think we were probably helped by at the 40. I don't believe he was healthy. He's since had that, core muscle surgery, but he ran 4.5, and our eyes sure didn't see a 4.5. Our
right.
eyes saw a guy that never got caught, you know, sure enough, when I talked to Herm said, don't believe that. He's a high 4.3 guy all day long. And ultimately what we liked about him, you know, Kyle and his staff, I mean, that's one reason when you talk about our hit rate on receivers, and it hasn't been perfect, but they do a tremendous job. They've been in this system for a long time. So, you know, when you're trying to project with all these college offenses, you have to look at traits, and that's what we do. We spend a lot of time, and sometimes it's what's a guy look like with the ball in his hands, because if he has that movement in him, we believe we can teach him how to run routes. And Brandon was a guy that we thought ultimately there were a couple guys in the draft that we thought ascended above everyone else, CD Lamb and Brandon, that had kind of, they could do it all. They had the strength to deal with all the holding and man-to-man bump and run coverage that's going on in today's football. But then the speed that with the ball in his hand, with the ball in their hands, or to separate before, you know, during the route, that is special. So kind of the complete package with him. And then talking to Herm, he really sold me on the kid. What, you know, how competitive the kid is. At the end of the day, I think once he passed Philly at 21, we picked Kinlaw at 14. Ayuk is the guy. Had we got stuck at 13, you know, a couple more moves, he would have been a guy we would have taken, and that probably would have raised some eyebrows.
Right.
But we really liked him. When he passed Philly at 21, Kyle and I looked at each other in that Zoom and said, we never intended to move up, but
yeah.
we at least have to give it a go. And fortunately, we were able to do something with Minnesota at 25.
It's interesting. Three of your five picks are SEC kids, a Tennessee receiver, a Georgia tight end, and Javon Kinlaw, South Carolina defensive tackle. I had a GM tell me years ago, he goes, outside a quarterback, if you just drafted all SEC players, you'd probably have a pretty good football team. I always feel it's easier to predict an SEC football player to the NFL because they're playing against more NFL bodies. So when I watch Javon Kinlaw, I look at him and I think, oh, he's beating guys in the SEC that are going to play in the NFL. That my theory has always been, if I was a GM, I would lean SEC, because if Tua can light up LSU on one leg, then Tua is an NFL quarterback. Do you ever think of it like that?
I think you do, and not necessarily like, hey, that's all we're focusing on. But I would tell you with Kinlaw, what I like to do, watch him against the best competition. His two best games this year were against Alabama
yep.
and Georgia,
yep.
I felt. And so when you can go up and dominate, yeah, these are guys who are going to play in the league. Also what happens, you develop relationships. We were incredibly comfortable with Will Muschamp because he gave us such an accurate depiction of Deebo Samuel last year. I didn't know Will. I had met him once, but we called on Deebo, and he hit all his strengths, but he also hit not even weaknesses, just realities of who the person is. And he depicted Deebo so well. A year later, I said, Kyle, we got to pick up the phone and call Will about Kinlaw, because he was so darn honest. And he said, absolutely. So sure enough, we made that call. You know, Muschamp goes above and beyond and telling me about Javon, the player, the person, then tells me, hey, call his junior college coach. He knows him better than anybody. So I call this guy Steve Buckley at Jones Community College. And, you know, I think you had to rely more on that kind of thing this year because we didn't have the 30 visits where we bring these guys in for 2 days and really get to know the person. So the relationships came in handy. But, yes, for the SEC players, Charlie Warner and Juwan Jennings are two players. And it does help when you see them against the best competition. Guys at Ohio State aren't bad either. not the SEC, but they got a load full of talent right now.
Trent Williams here. I mean, he's obviously a very good player. What if I say to you as a devil's advocate, John, he didn't play last year. There's no OTAs this year. Is he the same guy? Do you worry at all about that?
I think that's fair. I think we choose to look at it the other way. And Kyle's been around Trent a lot. I think at this stage in his career, maybe a year off might be the best thing for him. I think we're going to have really fresh legs. This is a guy who loves football, who stayed in great shape. You know, just guys like social media, do you use it in scouting? No. But one thing I did, he kept sending these videos, you know, of him working out. My goodness, he looked good. And so I know he still moves well. Yeah, there is some challenge when you've been away from the game for a little, but Kyle has a ton of comfort with Trent because he's coached him, and he's a guy who has a great passion for the game. I guess you take a little bit of leap there, but we needed to do something when, you know, Staley, who's been just a stalwart, a foundational player for this organization, both on and off the field, you know, decided to retire. We respected that decision, but we're very fortunate that Trent Williams was there to be had, and they made us sweat. They waited until day three. We certainly wanted that done before the draft, but Ron Rivera and I had good dialogue, and we were able to pull it off on day three of the draft.
Yeah, this whole, you know, it's funny, John. You're like Steve Kerr. Like anything you choose to do, you're going to work at it. You're going to be successful. You put in the time. Is there one thing about GM that is more challenging, maybe? I would have never guessed. I talked to a GM once about this, and he said, listen, man, he goes, you got an owner to balance. Yeah, I get calls at 3 a.m. He goes, you know, there's a little parental stuff going on here. That he was telling me this about a year ago. Is there something about the GM, having been a player, having been a broadcaster, that has been either cooler than you thought or tougher than you thought?
Oh, I think there's things on both sides. Cooler than I thought. It's really fun. I didn't realize how much I liked building things and looking at the entire picture. I've always kind of had a natural inclination to lead, an ability to bring people together. And I think that's one of my strengths is I'm not afraid. I think some people see it as a weakness to listen to a lot of people. There were a lot of smart people already in place. When I got to San Francisco, Parag Marate is a great example.
Yeah.
And he had been vilified a little, but he's brilliant. And he helps me a lot when it comes to thinking about salary cap and trades and things. Kyle is a guy. I wouldn't have done this had I not linked with the coach that I thought was special. Tougher, it just never stops, Colin. You know, it never stops. And you're right. At all hours, you better be available. I do think that's where having played, people say, you know, that non-traditional route. But being a player, it just, I think it gives you a great ability. The best teachers that I was around, the Tony Dungy's, the Bill Walsh's, the Mike Shanahan's, is just focus on what you can control. You got 1,000 things going, take one thing at a time. And I think having been a player, it is great training in that respect. And then you just trust your people. So we're having fun. You know, there's a lot of people that are real talented that I'm competing against, that we're competing against, and I'm enjoying it. I feel like we're getting better. Last year was tough getting that close, not pulling it off, but you know, we very much want to get back and put ourselves in position to compete for championships, and I think we've had a good offseason to do that.
Yes, you're getting the high draft grades. Great talking to you. Always appreciate it, and I follow you. There's very few people in sports that are easier to root for than John Lynch, buddy, and keep it up. Thanks, man.
Thanks for that, Colin. Best to you and your family.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
Ben Watson played 16 NFL seasons, 7 of the 16 with Tom Brady, and Brady referenced Ben Watson more than once when he left New England about their relationship. And we welcome Ben, who, by the way, 48 in a Wonderlic test. I have it here. Third highest in league history. He's the author of two books. Maybe that's why he and Brady got along. It was an intellectual thing and a physical thing. How close were, Ben, how close were Tom and you? I mean, he's referenced you multiple times. How close are you?
Hey, how you doing, man? Thanks for having me.
You bet.
This year, I would say, we were closer than we had been when I first got to New England. You know, I was there for 6 years, from 04 to 2010, left for about a decade and came back this year. And I think part of the reason was we were both the old guys on the team with have been married for multiple years and had kids and stuff. So we had a lot to talk about together over there in the old folks' corner of the locker room. So I think our relationship, I would say I got to know him in a different way than I did before when I was a lot younger. I have tremendous amount of respect for him. Obviously, as a player, we all know that. But to sit there with him, talk about our kids, FaceTime our wives, you know, those sorts of things that a lot of people don't think about is what I really truly appreciated, seeing that side of him in a different way over this past year.
So how is old mature Tom, because you're old mature Ben Watson, how's old mature Tom going to deal with all these young, energetic, lit wide receivers down in Tampa? You know, Ben, it's a different world. They're listening to different music. They're playing with different technology. How do you think he segues down there?
It is. The way that older players deal with it is on the field. Because when you get on the field, there's one person that needs to talk in that huddle, and that's going to be Tom Brady. He's going to command respect anyway just because of who he is. And then the fact that he's the quarterback, he's going to get in the huddle. He's going to listen to what nobody needs to talk. It doesn't matter what music you listen to. It doesn't matter what decade or really what millennia, for some of them, you're born in. It's about making plays and being accountable and all those sorts of things. In the locker room, however, you may not see him hanging out with them and trying to do all the dances, because as we get older, those things change. We just have different priorities.
Right.
But I think that what I did see from him, and the reason why he's so great, is that he's still very, very approachable. This is a guy who has had two Hall of Fame careers. This is a guy that when people come into the locker room, young men come into the locker room, they've had posters of him on their wall. They've played Madden with him for decades growing up. And you sit there and watch how guys are really scared to approach him sometimes, but how he's genuine with them. He's warm with them. He'll sign something for their dad or for their cousin. You know, he doesn't put on airs, and he's approachable in that way. And that's how it works. When you've got a guy that understands, you know, his position, the magnitude of who he is and what he's done in the game, but also the fact that he can be somewhat of an everyday teammate. From the guy who was, you know, the first one in the locker room on the roster, to the guy who's number 53 or the guy that's on practice squad.
I think three of my favorite quarterbacks in the last 10 years have been Russell Wilson, Andrew Luck, and Brady. And each occasionally there's pushback that are a little corny. And, you know, Russell, he's Mr. Optimism. But I think what you're saying is something that it appeals to me. I'm from a small town, Ben. And quarterbacks are already cast as stars. They get the best parking spot. They get the money. They get the endorsements. There is something about reaching down and connecting with people that I think, like, matters. And I don't know, you know, when you watched Tom grow, is one of the reasons it still works? Is that kind of folksy, small-town thing? I mean, I watched Andrew Luck congratulate guys who drilled him.
And, yeah, exactly.
You know, and Tom is, it's authentic, right? Like, this is who he is, right?
There's this crazy juxtaposition with his stardom globally, as well as in the NFL, and his folksy, friendly sincerity with the people that are in his circle and on his team. It's really interesting when you speak with people that don't know him, what are their opinions of him? And you may get a range, you know, he's a rock star, he's, you know, he's cocky, he's this, he's that. And then you talk to guys like many of the quarterbacks you just mentioned that are in the locker room with them, that see them every day, that have regular conversations with these guys and how they view them so differently. And I think that just shows the importance of being relatable, but yeah. also being trustworthy. We talk about trust and accountability so much in football and in team sports. But when you have a quarterback that you trust, obviously because he can perform, but also you know that when you meet his family, or he meets your family, he's going to shake their hand and give your mom a hug and a genuine smile. That makes you feel good. So there's definitely that combination that I think he's mastered, but also it really is who he is. I mean, he's a very sincere person.
Ben Watson joining us, total class, 16 NFL seasons, got two books, Under Our Skin, Getting Real About Race, and The New Dad's Playbook, played last year in New England. We all want to be loved, right? Like all of us do at some level. We may be big, strong, tough. We all want to be loved. And Joy and I would say sometimes, I just wanted Bill Belichick to give Tom a hug once. I mean, just once. I don't fault Tom if you told me he left because he just wanted somebody to give him a hug occasionally. I think part of Bruce Arians' appeal, Ben, is he's loose, he's fun, he's going to tell you he loves you. We don't mind getting chewed out as guys, but you got to tell us you love us once in a while. Do you think a little bit of him leaving is Belichick was just relentlessly tough on him?
I would agree with you that in the human condition, we want to feel appreciated. And we all have different ways that we feel appreciated. For some of us, it's getting chewed out. For some of us, it's gifts. For some of us, it is praise publicly. For some of us, it's physical affection. I want a hug, like you just said. Playing with Coach Belichick, for me and for a lot of people, he's a tough person to play for. He doesn't show you that. But when he does, it is that much more meaningful because you see that side of him, of how proud he is. But he works you really, really hard. And so I can't speculate on how much that played in the Tom Warner League. Look, he was there for 20 years, and they obviously had a great working relationship in that they won a lot together. They were successful. They pushed each other. I think that they were the perfect collision of a coach and a player that just worked when it came to creating a franchise and a team that could be successful over the longevity. People change over time. Our desires change over time. What we're willing to put up with changes over time. And sometimes we need new scenery. Sometimes things don't work out for all parties involved. And so I can't say that that's exactly what he wanted, and that's why he went to Tampa. I can say that I know that it's going to be a different experience for him.
Right.
And it may be one that he loves, or it may be one that, you know, he doesn't like as much as he thought he would. But the point there is that I'm happy he had an opportunity in his career to go somewhere else, to be a free agent. You know, he didn't leave anywhere. He was free. He could make a decision. The team could make a decision. He was free. And to go experience something else.
What do we know, Ben, about Jarrett Stidham? He's got a good arm. I'm not asking you to say he can or can't play, but, I mean, replacing Tom is like, in my business, replacing Howard Stern. Like, it's just not – I mean, seriously, it's replacing, Belichick or Nick Saban at Alabama. Emotionally, those are enormous shoes to fill. You've seen
Definitely.
Bits of him. What do we know about Jarrett Stidham?
What I do know about him, he comes into the locker room. He's a rookie, and obviously he's a quarterback. He's, for whatever that means, he's coming in with a guy, Tom Brady. But he has this quality about him that is fairly loose, that is able to make mistakes, which he made plenty of during training camp and mini camp and, you know, the preseason and even in the regular season when he got in. But at least on the surface, he was able to digest those mistakes, take the criticism, because there's a lot of that when you make mistakes in a place with very high standards. And he was able to come back and fight the next day. And I think that for him, that is going to be key, having the ability to be fluid, to not take yourself too seriously, to take criticism, to take coaching, not only from in the building, but also, as you mentioned, he's replacing Tom Brady. Or really not even replacing Tom Brady. He's just the next man up after Tom Brady. And so inherently there are going to be certain comparisons that are going to be made, even though they are unfair comparisons for a guy that's in his second year and a guy that had been playing for 20 years and won six championships. He's going to be able, I think, to weather that storm mentally, because that's the biggest thing for a quarterback. Are you mentally tough? You mentioned, yes, he can throw the ball. He can read, you know, coverages. He can do all those things. He's going to get better. But my sense from him is that he has a certain moxie and a certain mental toughness. And if that is true, that's going to be the most important thing for him this season, as opposed to anything else physical for him, because he's made no doubt about it. This is going to be somewhat of a competition. It's always a competition in New England. He's obviously the guy who was drafted last year, the guy who knows the most. I would say he has – it's his position right now kind of to lose. But here in New England with Coach Belichick, there's going to be somebody else that's going to be brought in. There's going to be an evaluation. There's going to be some sort of competition. It's not like he's an entrenched starter. So for him to have that sort of mental toughness is going to be key.
Finally, Ben Watson. What a pleasure to talk to Ben, who played in the NFL for 16 seasons, notably 7 of 16 with New England, Browns, Saints, Ravens as well. The virus. So we're still 5 months out for the start of the NFL season. If you were a player, I think it's unrealistic to think we're not going to have any cases or any deaths, perhaps for the next, until we have a vaccine, the next year. And we may still have cases, but we won't have the deaths. Would you be willing to go out there if, you know, it's a handful of cases, they took your temperature before every practice, they got rid of preseason, there's some adjustments, no Pro Bowl. Do you think most players, or even just you specifically, if it's not, we don't have a vaccine, but we are in a place where the numbers are down, would you be willing to play?
For me, it depends on what happens in the next few months. Let's say we're in a scenario where the cases, the amount of new cases starts to trend downward. Government, local, state, federal government starts to open us back up for normal business. There's still people getting sick, as you mentioned, but not as many people are fatalities. For me, yes, there's an inherent risk anytime you go outside that door. There's an inherent risk from other diseases as well, not just COVID-19. And so if we're in a situation where things are trending downward, maybe there's an adjustment as far as training camp goes. We're not at a place where we can actually have fans at training camp, maybe just players. A smaller group like that is much easier to monitor than the masses. And so for me, the risk would not be high enough for me not to go and to work. I think it's important that guys work if it's safe for them to do so. And I think that the majority of guys would be open to doing that. And look, I mean, honestly, we just don't know. Things may go as usual. We may open training camps on time. We may open the season on time. That's still a very high possibility. But if that does change, I think that most guys will err on the side of, look, being cautious and safe, monitoring their temperature, monitoring how they feel. Those are the same way that we do with a lot of other diseases that, come through, viruses that come through. And still look forward to going out there and getting back to work.
You are certainly always welcome on our show. A Georgia Bulldog, I remember. That's how old I am. I remember you in college.
Yeah, me too. Hey, it's been a long time, huh?
Yeah, it has. Hey, Ben, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. A credit to the game, and good luck with you and your family and every little thing, every big thing you do the rest of the way. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the time.